It is my pleasure at this time to introduce our main speaker, Jack B. from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jack Green, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome all the people that got tokens and cakes tonight, because that's really a nice thing to watch. No matter how long you're in the program, it's awesome. There's a type of power that will take somebody that comes in with all the wrong attitudes and doesn't want to be here and keeps them sober for 30 days and up to that first year, you know. And there's a different kind of power in these rooms that takes a man who's been sober, a man or woman who's been sober 15 or 20 years, and has got an entirely different lifestyle to contend with and keeps them maintaining their sobriety, you know. So there's a lot of power in rooms like this, you know. And if you're just brand new, then listen up, because all I intend to prove here tonight is show you how much that alcohol can ravage a human mind and body. And what can happen when you come to a place like Alcoholics Anonymous and finally become willing to make a change, you know? And I want to be able to portray that there's been an awesome change in my life. And I think that will be obvious from the result of this talk tonight. I think, like any alcoholic, my difficulties started long before I picked up a drink. I had an enormous inferiority complex. When I was about 11 years old, we moved to a farm, and I grew up in the country, and I thought that was a downgrade. When you went to school, you know, there was the farm kids, and then there was the real people. And so I was in that group, you know. And I was covered with acne. I'm as tall as I am now, over 6 foot tall. I weighed 145 pounds, you know. I was really ashamed of myself. I mean, there wasn't nothing right about me. I just didn't fit anywhere, and I didn't fit in this family. And I want to say that my mother and father are as normal as you can get. They're hardworking. They loved their children, and they did everything they could for them. And I felt unwanted, unloved, and apart from. And I remember only being about 12 years old and hanging with my head out the window crying, because I knew that this world was so screwed up, and I just didn't feel any reason to go on, you know. And I didn't have any friends. I sought escape compulsively from a very young age. As soon as I was old enough to read, I got into library books, and I read books going from class to class, you know, and where other kids talked to each other and made appointments to get together after work or school. All I did was read, and it isolated me and kept me apart from. And I didn't know anything about how to deal with life on any term until I ran away from home to join the military after high school. Some guys asked me if I wanted to go out to have a few beers, and I thought that sounded like a good idea. I was away from home now, you know, and if I did get drunk, wasn't anybody going to give me hell when I got home? And we went out to town in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I found out something for the very first time in my entire life that I could do good. I had two hollow legs. Man, they looked up to me. I mean, I put them down, and some of the others passed out, and we carried them to the car, and we come back in, and I drank some more, and they set some shots of old granddad in front of me, and I tried that too, and that stayed down. And I got drunk, but I didn't get out of control. I got real, real drunk, and earned a reputation for myself, and from that time on, it was easy to do all the things that I couldn't do before. You know, that was the great equalizer. I thought I had found the most magic elixir in the entire world. You know, I could drive better, talk to girls, do anything I wanted to do now, and I could do it better than anybody else. And gone was that restless stirring in the stomach and the gut and feeling different. But I had to drink to feel that way. And so I did, on a daily basis, for 13 years, you know. In the first 4 years in the military, nothing really unusual happened. I had blackouts from the first year I drank that lasted all night long. I didn't know what they were. I thought they were amusing incidences. You know, I thought it was kind of ridiculous when you spent 6 or 8 hours and you couldn't remember any part of it or who you were with or what you did. And other people made fun of me, but we just laughed it off. It was no serious big thing. When I got out of the service, I met with a friend of mine from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we went over to Chicago. And we were going to get some good jobs, you know, and have some fun in a big city. Within about a year, my lifestyle, I was still a loner. You know, I'm living with these guys in this beautiful house. And they all had a normal social life, and all Jack did was get off work and go drink, you know. And I became more and more apart from these people until they asked me to leave. And so I went and I got an apartment. And then I drank some more, and I lost the apartment, and I got a sleeping room, you know. And I drank some more, you know. I remember I was in my early 20s, and there was another guy named Jack who was 40 years old that worked at this place I worked. And he was an alcoholic. And we started to work at 8 o'clock, and the bar's open at 7. So at 7, we'd take off, and we'd sit in the bar, and we'd drink little 7-ounce bottles of beer and a shot of Jim Beam, along with 4 or 5 bottles of beer. And that was breakfast, and then we'd go to work. And at lunchtime, we went out and we drank a 64-ounce pitcher of beer for dinner, and we went back to work. And when we got off work, we went to the local tavern, and we drank beer until about 6 or 7, and then we went home and we ate supper. And he got dressed up in this fancy outfit, and he was a bartender at this cocktail lounge. And then we went over to the cocktail lounge, and we got serious, you know. And we had beds there, you know, just in case. And a lot of times we went to work right from there. And I thought this was all quite normal, you know. Thought this was all real quite normal. He even had a drunken parakeet. We'd sit in his house and I'd have a shot of Jim Beam, and that parakeet would come down and take some, till his head back up with about three of them, you know, and he'd be flying into the walls, and we thought that was hilarious. The local tavern we stopped in had a beagle hound. His name was Jack, too. We used to feed him glasses of beer until he'd go over under the bowling machine and burp and go to sleep. That poor dog, when we quit drinking, I don't know what he did. But I was supposed to be an assistant supervisor in an electronics plant, and my address had deteriorated to a point where I had to lie about what part of town I lived in. What I did was live in a transit neighborhood, and it was a pretty run-down neighborhood. And I think at the time I was paying something like $16 a week for a sleeping room, and it got to a point where they put a lock in the door because I couldn't ever pay my rent. And there was an abandoned car in an alley out back, and I used to sleep out there at times. And I'd wash my clothes out in some restroom, gas station restroom, and sit on their john leaning against the wall all night to sleep, and then walk 10 miles to work in Chicago in the wintertime. I'd worked in the supermarket in high school, and I knew that they threw parts of produce out that, you know, wasn't all bad, but if it just had a little blemish on it, they couldn't sell it. And it got to the point where I was dining at the back of the supermarket at 3 o'clock in the morning, because that's the only food I could afford to buy. I wasn't going to spend any of my money on anything except booze. Landlords didn't understand that. Bill collectors didn't understand that. Work didn't understand that. They had an honor system at work. They had soft drinks in the refrigerator, and you just went in, threw your coins into their little box, and helped yourself to soft drink. And the boss come to me one day, and he was telling me about they were having a serious problem with somebody who was going through the change box, and would I keep my eyes open for him? All right. You know? I mean, in them days, a 7-ounce glass of beer cost 10 cents, you know, so you could go pretty far in a couple of dollars for it. And I always made sure I always had at least a couple bartenders that I had that I had credit with. Another way I continued to drink was that they had some machines in these bars that were absolutely fantastic for making money on. They were bowling machines. They had a big round ball that you rolled down and picked up the pins. And no matter how much I drank, I could do 300 games like that. And I could walk in broke and borrow a couple quarters from the bartender, and I'd be rolling. We bowled for, you know, there'd be four of us, and the lowest person had to buy a round of drinks and put the money in the machines again. So if I had a couple quarters to get started, I not only drank, but sometimes we played for money. I'd go in broke and get drunk and walk away with $40 in my pocket. I thought that was pretty neat. And these people were bound and determined that the more I drank, the worse I'd play, and it didn't work that way. So that's part how I supported myself, because I had an expensive habit. I had two hollow legs. And things got so bad that I was hanging around on a street in Chicago called Wilson Avenue. And it was nobody worked on that street. Well, not the kind of work we're familiar with. It was a mixed bag of people, you know. There was Indians there. There was black people. There was Southern hillbillies. And it was just a little rough. Most of the people stole for a living or hustled or were prostitutes or one way or another. They made a buck illegally. And I definitely didn't tell anybody I had a job that I managed to get to most of the time. And it was a time when I realized that the next step to this street, Wilson Avenue, was downtown Madison Avenue on Skid Row. And I knew that. And I kept hawking everything I owned and to support my drinking. And I was getting sick. And I wanted to change. I wanted to really change it. I didn't want to be that way. You know, I thought there had to be more to life than just staying drunk all the time and going to work just long enough to get enough money to drink some more. And I thought, there's got to be more to Jack Green than this. But believe me, I was trying as very hard as I could to be the most that I could be at that time, and that was it. You know, sleeping in an abandoned car and eating at the back of a grocery store. And that's the most that I could be at that time. I was instilled with an honesty system from my parents that lasted all through my drinking. I remember not eating for two or three days, and I went in a little store, and it was in the wintertime, and I had a big jacket on. A can of soup cost 10 cents, and I knew that I could take the can of soup and put it in my coat and go back and warm it up, and it would really help. And I couldn't do that. You know, I thought, what if somebody found out? What if my parents heard that I got arrested for stealing? And I couldn't live with that, so I went hungry. I remember going to church, and there was a man named Dr. Preston Bradley. And I went into church and I listened to his sermons, and it was something about this man. I mean, it was an aurora about him. I mean, he was very dynamite. And yet I looked around at the other people in that church, and they weren't like me. They had nice clothes, and they come there with their families, and they talked about going out to dinner afterwards, you know. And I wasn't a part of there either. But that man said something that saved my ass and saved my life a few times, and that was, he said something simple as, when you feel that you're at the end of your rope, he says, tie a knot and hang on, and something will happen to change it. And when I was ready to cash in a couple times, I thought about that, and I tied a knot mentally in what was going on in my life. And I hung on, and sure enough, I was able to straighten out just a little bit more. And finally, when I thought, knew I was losing it, and I knew I didn't want to go to work anymore, and I knew I was headed for Madison Avenue, I was standing in a phone booth. You know, I was about 24 years old. I'm standing in a phone booth on Wilson Avenue, and we're going to call Alcoholics Anonymous, and I put the dime in, and I just couldn't dial, you know. I looked at that phone and I said, God damn, Green, you ain't that bad. All you got to do is pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get your ass in gear, and straighten your goddamn life out. Quit playing run into Alcoholics Anonymous games. I hung up the phone and I quit my job and I went back to Pennsylvania because I knew if I lived in the same town as my parents that I couldn't possibly live the lifestyle I had been existing as at that time. And I went back there and I stayed there 4 years. In the first few years, I got a job and I bought some riding horses and built a stable, and the kids in the neighborhood all used to come over and ride, and everybody thought Jack was a pretty nice guy. And then I kind of thought I owed it to myself to do a little more drinking, and the drinking got really bad. I smashed up a couple cars of my parents, and I quit going to work, and I quit paying room and board, and I was just a general nuisance, and they really didn't know what to do with me. And just before I got thrown out of the house, I found this great new job 200 miles away in New York. I went up to Rochester, New York, and interviewed for the job and passed all the tests until I got to my physical. And by this time, I was so bad that, I mean, I was really in pitiful shape. And they took my physical and they said, Jesus Christ, man, you're almost dead. They said, you want a job, you pass all the written tests and everything like that, we're willing to hire you, but you better take a couple months and go to the hospital and get yourself straightened out. So I went back to Pennsylvania and I quit drinking for a whole month. You know, I was really proud of myself. I mean, I had to get a job, don't you know, to support my habit. And it was about 2 months later that I went back and I just squeaked by the physical examination, and I got a pretty good job, made decent money. But this was the beginning of the end. This was only two years before I quit drinking. The only people I associated immediately fell in with the practicing alcoholics. I didn't know it at that time, but, you know, that's exactly what they were. The only couple friends I had drank just like me. We couldn't wait to get off work. We went and drank lunch. We went out after and drank all night long until it was time to go back to work again if we could make it. There was a point about 6 months before I quit drinking. I was supposed to go to work in the afternoon at 3:30. And I stopped in a bar about noon. And, I mean, I was really sick. I didn't know you could hurt that bad. And I didn't have money to spend on booze, that's for sure. You know, they were trying to repossess my car. I had to park at a different place every night. I could only go in my apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning when the landlord was asleep because I hadn't paid rent for a couple months. And there was no reason I should have been taking a drink. And I knew that I was going to order a beer, and I knew that I was going to drink it, and that scared the hell out of me because I had always said that I could stop any time. And that day I knew I couldn't stop no matter how bad I wanted to stop, that I was going to drink that beer no matter what it did to me and whatever it did to my life and whatever the consequences were, I was going to drink that beer. And I ordered a beer and I drank it. And now I was running scared because I just was totally out of control. My life was unmanageable. I knew it. And I tried everything I could to straighten my life out. I didn't think about not drinking the rest of my life. That was a little too far-fetched. But I really humbled myself. You know, I went in and I told them at work that I was having a great amount of trouble dealing with life, and I really didn't know what to do, that I wanted to be a better employee. They sent me to see a shrink. And I said, wait a minute. So I said, well, you know, why not? This is the ultimate, you know, I mean, I'll really humiliate myself. I'll go see this goddamn doctor. And so they set me up an appointment, and I went and I talked to a psychiatrist. I think I went there about 4 or 5 times. Every time I go talk to him for an hour, I had to pay for this, about $50 at that time. And then I go across the street to the bar, and I get a bottle of Budweiser and a shot of old granddad and contemplate what we had talked about. And after about the 5th session, I decided that I didn't tell, or that son of a bitch didn't tell me anything I didn't already tell him first. And I was paying him $50 for this. So there it is, you see. I had tried the ultimate. I had went to a shrink to straighten out my life. and nobody really understood it, and there was no way anybody could help me, and that this was the best it ever was going to be, and so I might as well drink myself to death. And it was only a short time later that I was at work in the second shift, and we went out at lunchtime, and I had some beer. And when I got time to go back to work that time, I just didn't want to go back. It was Wednesday night, and I just kept on drinking. And I drank Thursday and Thursday night and Friday night. And somewhere Friday, about 7 o'clock at night, I ordered a mixed drink in a bar that I was familiar with in my town. When I woke up, it was Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd been in a blackout. I come to in the back of my car. And I was so far away from the town that I lived in that I had to get a road map to find out how to get back. And I didn't know where I had been. And I was really scared about what I had did. And I checked my car over real closely, and I was really scared that I'd run over a child. That I could have run over a child and killed it and not known it. And it really scared me. And Saturday I drank, but I couldn't drink very much. For some reason my tolerance had dropped off, and I thought that was a sign I was losing my masculinity, and that really hurt. And I isolated myself, and I didn't talk to anybody. But I couldn't drink like I used to drink. My tolerance had dropped off. In here I learned that that's the chronic stages of alcoholism, where your ability to hold alcohol drops off. And finally, Sunday, I was only able to get down 4 or 5 beers. And come Monday, I actually got out of bed and thought that I was going to go to work. In the meantime, I stopped about noon on a real hot August day, and I ordered a glass of beer at Elmer's Inn prior to going to work. And I took a sip of beer, and I swallowed it 3 or 4 times. And I got off the stool, and I went in the men's room, and I threw it up. And I come back out, and I put a little tomato juice in it, and I took another swallow. And I swallowed it 3 or 4 times, and I went in the men's room, and I threw it up. And about the third swallow of beer, I found out that, you know, there wasn't going to be any drinking that day. My body totally rejected alcohol. It reached its capacity for holding any kind of alcoholic beverage in any way, shape, or form. And I had nothing left to do except crawl out to my car and drive to this little sleeping room in a rundown hotel. As I laid down that afternoon on the bed, I was real sick. I was real confused, and I was real scared. And I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't care anymore. I didn't care what my parents thought of me. I didn't care if I went to work again. I didn't care if I died. And some lights started coming through the window and going across the ceiling. I thought it was just headlights from a car. And then the shadows took on colors, vivid colors, psychedelic colors. And I thought, some son of a bitch put LSD in my beer, you know. And because I don't take dope. And so I laid there a little bit longer, you know. And up till this point, I had been a social drinker. And laying there in that bed that day, I thought I was. Laying there in that bed that afternoon, I had to say, "Breen, you're an alcoholic. Social drinkers don't have DTs, you know. And now what the fuck are you going to do?" And the only thing I knew about AA was people who went there didn't drink. And that was pretty goddamn strange to me. I didn't know anybody that didn't drink for a good many years. It was a couple days before I was strong enough to get out of bed. And I went to a phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked if there was a meeting, and she told me where it was, and I said, "That's 3 miles from here, and I haven't got a car." And she said, "Well, if you want to get there, you'll be there." And she hung up. I heard a lot of other stories, you know, that didn't happen that way to me. But I walked that 3 miles, goddammit. I walked a lot more for a beer, so I walked 3 miles to a meeting. And when I got to the meeting, I got in the parking lot, and I looked around, and I said, "Holy shit, there was Mercedes-Benz and Cadillacs," and I thought, "Well, this don't work, you know. They'll never let me in here. Ain't no way. If they know anything about me, they're going to let me in that door, you know." And I must have stood out there about a half an hour, and then I realized, you know, there was tears running down my cheeks, and I was sicker than I had ever been in my life. And I knew that I was either going to go down those steps and see what was going on in that room, or I was going to die. And so I went down the steps alone, and I walked into my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. They were very understanding people. They brought me a cup of coffee about this high and only put this much coffee in it. They took me over to a chair and they set me down and they put an old-timer on the other side of me. And they introduced themselves and they didn't seem too threatening, you know. And they didn't ask a lot of questions, and that was good. And I got to tell you that the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't tell you one single word that was said. I was too sick, way too far gone to understand what was being said at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I saw was a bunch of average-looking people that didn't seem to be harming me in any way. But the only thing that I got out of that meeting was something deep down inside my gut. And that was hope that somehow I could come from where I was to where some of those people talked about them being, you know. They talked like they had felt like me. They talked like they had done some of the things I did. And yet they weren't like that today. They were dressed nice. They had smiles on their faces. You know, and I liked that. And I wanted to be like that. After the meeting, somebody said, you want to go to a meeting tomorrow night? And I said, why, this meeting won't be here next Wednesday? And they said, well, yeah, but... And I said, well, you know, I got my whole goddamn life to straighten out. I'll be here next Wednesday. And I was. I might have been sick, but I was still arrogant. And I was still stubborn, and I still had to do it my way. And so I come to AA meetings, and I'd listen to what I wanted to listen to. I wouldn't listen to him because he'd been in mental institutions, and that wouldn't have been to jail, and that's the woman, I can't listen to her. And, you know, there were very few people that I could listen to, you know. And this was going to take a long time. And I got to say, I was able to do it my way for a whole year and a half. And at the end of a year and a half, one day, I'm driving down the road in my car. I said, Breen, where the hell are you going? So I turned the car around. I'm going the other way, and I didn't know where I was coming from. And I knew something was drastically wrong, you know. I was either going to go insane, really flip out completely. I was going to get drunk. Well, I had to go to you and tell you that I had a problem I didn't know how to deal with. And about that time, somebody come up to me and they said, hey, Jack, there's a young people's conference. Saw young people, about 100 of us, are getting together at this retreat for a weekend. Jesus Christ, nothing else is going right. Half of the young people are female young people, so I'm going. Sign me up, you know. And that's the reason I went. But that was the beginning of a new way of life for me, because what I found there that weekend was people who got down to the itty-gritty of things. On Friday night, we had to come to a podium like this, and I had never done that before. And what you did was, to get acquainted, you come up here and you told who you were, how long you'd been sober, and what was going on in your life at that time. And what happened for me was I got up there, and all I was really, really horrified. And I was standing there twisting my thumbs, and my legs were rubber. And I did something at that time that was 10 times harder than the DTs. And that was that I had to tell you people that I didn't have the answers to how to make my life work. That I wanted to be a better person the worst kind of way, and everything was turning out shit and down. And they jumped up and put their arms around me, and they said that they understood. And they said it was going to be all right. And I get emotional when I talk about that weekend, because when I talk about it, I'm there. People sat down, a couple named Denny and Joanne, and they talked to me about things that I'd never heard anybody talk about before. And they should have been ashamed to say them. They should have been devastated. And yet they spoke about these things very lightly. And they said that it was only things that they had to do when they put alcohol and drugs in their system. And that today they were free of that. And that today they could live a life they didn't believe possible for them. And only because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous were willing to help them walk a way they had never walked before and that they didn't know existed. And that they were willing to help me now that I had finally asked for help. Before that weekend was over, I realized that there was a God. That there was a God that loved people very much, who was... His influence that weekend was so profound. I remember a man who had been sober 5 years and was a proclaimed atheist. And I guess just the spirituality, the spirit of God was so heavy there that about mid-Saturday afternoon he fell down on his knees. And he started to cry. And he begged God to forgive him. That he realized that there was a God. And he wasn't it. And that the reason he couldn't make things work right was because he hadn't surrendered. I remember that, and it was impressive. Now, I want to tell you, I had gone to church as a child, and I realized there were some good things about God, but he had done me so many dirty tricks that I had walked away from him at age 21. And now, once again, I was feeling that this God had something good and something powerful. And I felt it, and I wanted it, but I was afraid. But somewhere, people, somewhere deep down in me, I found some guts. And I went and I talked to these people that had God written all over them. And I wanted to know what they did, how they felt, where they got what they got. And I listened with rapt attention when they told me. And whatever they said to do, I went and I did. And it was the beginning of my growth as a man and as a human being and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I committed myself to working the 12 steps to the very best of my ability. And what I got myself involved with was a bunch of young people, that about 15 or 20 of us, and we got together on a regular basis a couple times a week. And we really got on each other's cases. And we worked these steps together, and we kicked ass on one another, and we forced one another to talk about exactly what was going on. There was no bullshitting. And we got to know each other so well that you could walk in with a smile on your face, and 5 minutes later, everybody was in your shit because they knew better, you know. And they drew it out of you. And there was no hiding in this group. I ain't kidding you. I mean, we would go to the beach all day and we'd play ball and we'd play in the ocean and we'd do all these things, you know, but we all knew. It always was the same. We went to somebody's house. We turned out the lights. We sat on cushions. We sat on the floor. We lit a couple candles and we made a podium. If it was an orange crate on a kitchen chair, that was a podium. And you got up and you went and you stood in the front of your peers and you told what the hell was going on with your life, you know, and what was going on with working the steps for you that day. And if we thought you were telling the truth, fine. If you needed help, we gave you help. If you needed your ass kicked, you got your ass kicked. And nobody lied too often in those meetings and in that fellowship and in that people that grew. And those people are all sober today. You know, all those people I started with, and this was back in 1970, 71. It was back in New York. Back there they told you, you know, you got two ears and one mouth. You put the cotton in your mouth and listen. The only thing that you can tell the first year is how to be a failure, and we already know that, you know. So you haven't got anything to say. So I did a lot of listening, and I did a lot of reading. And even though for a while I was scared, I thought I wasn't an alcoholic because I heard mental institutions, I heard drunken driving, being arrested for drunken driving, I heard wife beating, I heard a lot of things that didn't have anything to do with me. I was the guy they always passed the keys to. That Green drive, man, he can handle it, no sweat, you know. And I always was the last guy after everybody else passed out. And, you know, I couldn't identify for the longest time. But in that literature, because I was hiding out from all of you, I saw certain things, certain feelings, certain fears, certain things run amok in my life that I identified with. And I said, well, you know, if all these things are true, I guess it don't really matter if I went to jail, you know. And it really doesn't, you know. If you drink, even if it's only once a year, and you can't predict what's going to happen, and when it happens you don't like it, you belong here. And people said, did you ever ask yourself if you were an alcoholic or not? I said, well, yeah, I used to ask myself, but about nothing, they said. Social drinkers never ask. Wait a minute. Give me a break. I was sober about 2 years, and somebody said they would be smart. I was going to a young people's group, and they said, we need a GSR. Oh, what the hell is a GSR? General Service Representative. I mean, you get in your car once a month, and you drive anywhere within 100 miles, and you attend a meeting. A statewide meeting, and they're talking about AA worldwide, you know, and you're going to be the group representative, and you get to go to these meetings, and you get to bring back the information to all of us so we know what's going on worldwide. You know, I was really impressed. It got to my ego. I thought, Jesus, these people trust me to drive 100 miles? They even gave me $5 for gas, you know. And I thought, I don't have to go to that meeting, but, you know, I said, they gave me $5. I'm going to go. So I started going to GSR meetings. Well, the meeting was at 2 o'clock. And usually because I had never been to the town before and I didn't know where the church was, I made sure I got there early enough to have lunch and then get over to the church early. Well, my General Assembly meeting was 2 o'clock, and at 1 o'clock there was another kind of meeting everybody kept going to. It was called H&I. Now, what the hell is H&I? So one day I didn't have anything else to do, and I walked in and I sit in on the meeting. And it was hospitals and institutions. And I said, God, I've never been to them. I don't hear this shit. You know? So I listened to it, and a couple people in there knew me, and they said, well, we're glad to see you, Jack. Why don't you come to this meeting in Rochester? And next thing I knew, I was going to, I was all involved in service work, you know. And let me tell you, I had a personality conflict with people in the young people's group in my hometown. And it would get to a point where I would quit going to the meetings there. And the only meeting that I looked forward to going to, the only thing that saved my sobriety and saved my ass, was the fact that once a month I went to a GSR meeting. And there I met a special kind of people, people that cared about other people, people that were grateful for their sobriety and the way they had been able to change their life, and they were working to help other people reach the same thing. And I liked that about those people, and I made some good friends there. And I would go to these meetings, I kept going back, and it was probably 3 years of going to that GSR meeting before I really got my head straightened around at these young people's conferences and with that group I told you about, where I could apologize to the people that I was holding resentments against in the young people's group in my hometown, and where I could actually become a part of the group there, you know. So, and what I'm saying is that if it wasn't for service work, I wouldn't be here today. And I did a lot of different kind of service work. I was single. I had no responsibilities. I made good money. What happened was I moved into a rooming house, and there was a guy there that was the president of National Council of Alcoholism. And there was another man who lived there whose name was Einar Madsen, and he was a professional, and he was the son of alcoholic parents. And it didn't take very long for us to set up a trio, and we went around to colleges, and we went around to high schools, and we went around to any place that they would invite us, And Bob spoke as a professional in the field of alcoholism as a disease. And I spoke as the alcoholic, the recovering alcoholic. And I imagine spoke as what it was like to be the son or daughter of practicing alcoholics. And that was another couple of years that I did that. And I really got a lot out of that. And I remember going to schools and we used to ask questions, let the kids ask questions afterwards. And the way I worked it was that I would tell them not, they had to write the question on a piece of paper and they didn't put their name on it. And then they all threw it in a hat. And that way nobody knew. When I answered the question, nobody in the room knew who I was talking to or about. And I was really a guest. I did not know. I thought alcoholism was my disease. And what I learned from them kids was that they were well in tune and well aware of alcoholism, the disease, whether it was in the mother, the father, the brother, sister, or their own self at 8 or 9 years old. You know, it was a real awakening into the world of alcoholism in this society. Somewhere along the line, somebody got me interested in going to Attica State Prison. And that was really a trip. I mean, that was a trip. I mean, we went in there and you went through a sliding door and there was a guy standing in a cage with a machine gun and you went into a little entryway and a gate closed behind you and then this one opened. And they had the other guys locked up in cages and they'd hang there yelling things at you as you walked by. You weren't very popular in there. And you had to go through 7 different doors into 7 different levels of that prison and then up to the 3rd floor. And they locked us in a room with a couple hundred cons. And they shut a steel door about that thick and turned it with a key that long. And you were in there for 2.5 hours. And I looked around, well, this shit works, you know. But I met some people in there that made me very, very grateful for the freedom that I had, you know. There was a man in there that I met that, I think he was about 21 years old, right? He's going to spend the rest of his life in Attica State Prison. And what happened, he was just a little social drinker having a beer one night. And he remembered ordering a beer about 10 o'clock at night. And the next day he woke up and he was all beat to hell. And he was in prison and the cops weren't treating him very good. And nobody would talk to him. And finally they got, you know, okay, well, I don't remember. Why am I in here? And what happened was that half of the bar had walked out in the alley when they heard screaming and trying to take a butcher knife and cut a 17-year-old girl's head off. And there he is. In Attica, he learned he was an alcoholic. In Attica, he learned that he was out of control because he drank alcohol. He did not want to hurt anybody. He did not ever want to hurt anybody before he drank. He did not want to hurt anybody now. But when alcohol was in him, he lost control. And for him, it put him in Attica for the rest of his life. You know, and I would have an AA meeting there, and I would have feelings similar to an AA meeting on the outside. And yet I could walk out of those cold gray walls when them doors closed behind me for the last time. I was so goddamn grateful. I had the freedom to go home. I had the freedom to go out and visit the mountains. I had the freedom to go to a friend's house, to eat in a restaurant, to do all the things that those people couldn't do. And a lot of them were in there because they were alcoholics, you know. Because somewhere along the line, they went over that line and they did something and society didn't like it. And that's where they are. Some of them had to do it over and over and over again and go to the county jails and then make the big time, you know. And so I did that. I was moderator at Attica State Prison for another 5 years. And I cleared the people to get in there, and I took them in, and I put on the AA meeting for the people. You know, and it was a very beneficial cleansing and a perspective aligner for Jack Breen. It allowed me to learn exactly who I was and what could happen to me and to see the progression of alcoholism in a human mind and body. There were many, many people in my sobriety that served to teach me the lessons. A lot of failures. A lot of people that didn't make it went ahead of me to prove to me that if I didn't get serious about this program, that someday I wasn't going to be here, that I would go back to drinking, and drinking would be suicide. I would be dead. I remember a man named Curly. Again, I was sober a couple years, and I was kind of bored, and I was toying with the idea. I don't even smoke regular cigarettes. I'm thinking about smoking marijuana because just staying sober wasn't all that great. And this guy talked about using drugs and alcohol. And as he talked, his drinking and his lifestyle was just exactly like mine, right up to the point he had DTs. After he had the DTs, he continued to drink. That's the only part different. You know, all that time I'm going, rah, rah, rah. You know, he's a big-time speaker up here, you know, and he drank just like me, did all these things. What happened was, about 6 months after the DTs and he had continued drinking, he was married and his wife had asked him to leave because she couldn't put up with his drinking. And she was a waitress and she was in this restaurant in Canada. And so he drank for 2 weeks. He kept going in there and begging her to take him back, and she said, no, I can't do that. And so finally he walked in there one day after a 2-week bender, and he picked up a butcher knife in front of all the customers and he stabbed her to death. And again, the man is in prison in Toronto and they threw the key away. And Alcoholics Anonymous went into that prison. And eventually he heard about it. And he made fun of it. Because he could drink like a man. Eventually, some way, somehow, he wound up at that AA meeting. And eventually, after many years, Canadian authorities were willing to recognize the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous had a part of changing. He was real radical in the prison. You know, he was real good at beating people up and getting his way. And he had a complete turnaround. And they noticed that. And they knew it was only after he had gone to AA meetings. And what they did was they put him on an airplane and they took him to Buffalo, New York. And they sent him over to the States. And they said, if you ever come back across the line, we'll shoot you. And he took up residence in Ohio. You know, and to the best of my knowledge, the man is still sober today. And this was back again in the early 70s. I was in a halfway house early in my sobriety. After 6 or 7 months of sobriety, I went to a halfway house, and there was a man named Jimmy there, and he was a taxi driver. And Jimmy had been in and out of the halfway house, you know, and he walked around with 300 Valium in his pocket, jingling all the time, you know. And he was just a happy-go-lucky guy, and nothing bothered Jimmy. And Jimmy would stay sober 2 months, and Jimmy would stay sober 6 months, and he'd go drinking again. And I tried lots and lots of times to talk to Jimmy, and they called me radical, you know. I was real gung-ho for AA while I stayed there. And let me tell you, I stayed at halfway house a year and a half, and there's only two of us in a whole year and a half that are still sober today, you know. I was the radical one, and all the ones that knew it all are drunk or dead. And that's what happened to Jimmy. One day, there was a state hospital for alcoholism in Rochester, New York, where I got sober, and they had meetings there on Wednesday night. And I went over there and I saw Jimmy coming across the grounds and I called out to Jimmy. Jimmy was too far gone by this time. Jimmy didn't know who I was. You know, he just walked along. And a couple weeks later, Jimmy was dead. You know, but he didn't need AA. There was another young man, 21, 22 years old, and he comes to the meetings. And he was real gung-ho. Had a beautiful wife and he had just had a little baby boy. And he'd been in and out of the program for 3 or 4 years at that young age. And he finally decided that this is it. I am going to commit myself to this program. And one night, I heard him talk at a meeting and the hair went up on the back of my neck and I realized the man was really, really sick. And about two weeks later, I went to a Wednesday night meeting at the state hospital and there he sat. And he didn't know his own name. He was just rocking back and forth like this. And they finally carried him away upstairs. Now upstairs, they had a place for the wet brains. And people write, there's absolutely nothing more wrong with those people than that they said they were social drinkers until they didn't even know their own name. Because when they didn't know enough to eat, they went to the bathroom whenever they had to. They had absolutely no control over their life. They were wet brains. And I used to go up on that floor and I'd open the door and I'd stand there. And the nurse would say, they're just alcoholics, you know. That's the only thing wrong with them. That's all. They just wouldn't quit drinking. And I'd get downstairs to the meeting on Wednesday night. And I'd be so goddamn grateful that somehow I knew enough not to drink. That no matter what was going on, I could make it better if I stayed here and I worked with these people and I did what they told me. About 6 years sober. You know, famous last words of an alcoholic. It sounds like a good idea at the time. I don't know, everything was going well and I decided to get married. You know? And about 2.5 years later, I had a home, and I had 2 new cars, and I had a good job with Eastman Kodak, and we had money in the bank. About a month later, I didn't have any of those things. And I remember walking across the bridge, much like the Coronado Bridge. It's a couple hundred feet over, about 2 foot of water and a lot of rocks, and people used to all the time. And I had to walk over that bridge to go to work. And I walked over the bridge, and I had 8 years of sobriety, and I was stripped to absolutely nothing. And I knew exactly how those people felt when they took that bridge. Yet I had a warm feeling inside of me because the God that I knew, the Alcoholics Anonymous Fellowship that I belonged to, allowed me to know that if I put one foot ahead of the other and I tried to do God's will for me today, that everything would be all right. And there absolutely was no reason in God's world for me to jump over that bridge. You know, that anything I had up till now. Nothing's forever. Nothing's guaranteed. You just put one foot ahead of the other. I had 8 years of sobriety, I had a sense of humor, you know, and I had a God that loved me, you know. And that's all I needed. I said, I started from scratch very, very sick 8 years ago, you know. And I reached the podium of success. And I said, I'll just do it all over again, I don't care, you know. And I wound up in California, and I really liked it out here. I got connected with a good job at General Dynamics within the first year, and things just went along uphill from then on, you know. I got another house, you know. I own a nice home in Santee, and it's been filled with a lot of art objects and things that I didn't even know I had an interest in 10, 15 years ago. That's a real nice place to go home to. It's my castle, you know. It's not to be compared with anybody's castle in La Jolla or Ocean Beach or wherever, you know. It's my castle. It's what makes me comfortable. It's what makes me feel good. And it's filled with things that make me feel, that are an expression of Jack Breen, of my interests and my taste, of what makes me feel comfortable and good, you know. And today I step out easy in life. Today I'm comfortable and I'm serene and I like what's going on. And that's, you know, like 99% of the time. I have a bad day about once every year and a half, you know. I think God just wants me to let me know what it still feels like, you know. So you think this is a free ride. I never took this program for granted. I say I'm taking out insurance when I go to a meeting, when I call some new kid up and say, hey, want to go to a meeting? And he, Jesus, Dream wants to take me to a... Yeah, I'll be ready in a minute, you know. He's doing me more good than I'm doing him, you know. I know where my side my bread's buttered on, you know. I know exactly what I have to do to keep this program ingrained into my life. I want to say something else about a God, because that's what I live for today, and that's why I'm alive today. I know that. When I was about 3 years sober, I got enough spirituality from people like you that I was really curious about. You know, I knew that whenever things got really down, I could go to God, and I would ask him, and like that, it was answered, you know. I immediately had an answer, and things were resolved, and it worked out better than I could ever dream. The only people I knew were Catholics. And I was raised Protestant, but I was thirsty to know more about God. I knew a lot by coming to these meetings, but it wasn't enough. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know for my own personal reasons. God was something at that time kind of distant. You know, every once in a while, a little bit of his goodness would dribble into my life. And I went to the Catholic Church, and I listened to what they had to offer, and I took what I wanted, what made sense to me. And I went to the Pentecostals, and I went to the Holy Orders, and I went to every kind of church and religious experience that was gone, and I listened, and I paid attention, and I used, and I built together a spiritual program. And I got to give it to the Catholics once again. They hold something called a crucial. It's a weekend movement where you go in, you take off your wristwatch, you don't make any phone calls. There's no sense of time whatsoever from Thursday afternoon to Sunday. And this whole weekend, this whole program, is for you to get to know Jesus as your own personal Savior, or to know God on a personal one-to-one basis, okay? And I got to tell you that at the end of that weekend, not before the weekend was over, what I knew was that there was a God, and he knew Jack Breen as an individual, that he understood everything about me, that he loved me very much, and he would do anything, absolutely anything, anytime. All I had to do was ask. And I was just overwhelmed. I knew that. I know that just like I know this in my right hand, you know. And no one could ever tell me different, ever again. I realized that if I did every day what God wanted me to do, the things would be so good, I couldn't stand it. It got so better. I mean, there was no way that I could dream or sit down and design the kind of lifestyle that I wanted that would make me comfortable and make me happy. And yet, if one day at a time you get out of bed and you do what you think to the best of your ability, what God wants you to do, I guarantee you, it'll be different. But it'll be so good that you'll wonder why you ever did it your way again. What I'm saying is it requires a humility before this God. That this God is all loving and all understanding and all willing to help, but he demands certain things. He gave you a free will. And if you say, I want to do it my way, he says, go ahead and take your licks. And when you're tired of taking your licks, come talk to me. You know, he doesn't force it on you. He never will. You can die not asking God for help. And he won't interfere because he gave you free will. But I pursued this God. And I thought, you know, if he'll come to me in that, oh, maybe every 3 months it was, where I really didn't know what to do. I really couldn't get something just screwed around the way I wanted it. And I would take it to him. And immediately it was corrected. And finally I got the message that, you know, maybe if he's that good and he's that willing to help, what would happen if I developed on a day-to-day basis a rapport with this God that I really tried to understand with the very depth of my being what he wanted me to be doing each day? You know, if I could say to myself at any time, any day, Jack, is this what God would want you to be doing today? Sure, it sounds funny. It sounds damn strange if you're brand new, but I got to tell you that doing what God wanted me to do has been the most comfortable thing that I ever did in my life. It has brought more friends and more love and more respect into my life than I would have ever asked for. It's given me a chance to be something I never thought I could be. You know, every area of my life has improved. I remember I was in high school and I always wanted to go out for track, you know, or some kind of athletics. You know, they got them sweaters with the nice sweaters they used to give to the girls when they were the heroes. And I wanted one of them, you know. So I go out for track and they take the four or three further high jumpers, you know, and I'd be four, you know. And 100-yard dash, same thing. They take three fastest people and I'd come panting in four. And I tried out for basketball and I tried out for all of it. And I always failed. And then when I got sober, I found out I had not the greatest heart in the world, and I went to do some exercising and some jogging, and I started pushing my body. Instead of being lazy, I pushed it to limits I didn't know I could. And what I found out was that I wound up being better than average, a lot better. You know, I remember I was 46 years old. I run a 2-mile race with people of all ages, and I come in second. You know, and I realized that the only thing different from there and from high school was I didn't ever try. Now, I don't know that the three people that got on the team weren't out there every night after school practicing. That's what they should have been doing. That's what they probably were doing. But see, I didn't think like that at that time. And so in every area of my life, I've been able to improve. I've been able to grow. I remember when I was in school in the Air Force, a young kid, I was so intimidated by every other human being. I was less than anybody. And when they called me to the board to describe some electronic circuitry, up here I knew the answer. But when I got up here in front of all you, my mind just went blank and I couldn't, you know, I looked like the biggest dummy you ever saw. I'd stutter and I'd stamper and I just didn't know. And they didn't understand how I could pass the test. When I was alone and nobody bothered me, I could write what I had heard. But I couldn't do it in front of a... All my life in work and jobs, I had always disassociated myself from, like, bosses were lived in some other world, you know? I mean, you just don't talk to bosses. They're the gods, and you're just a flunky, and you just go in and do your thing. And that's the way I felt, and I didn't know any different. And I never understood when I saw one of the workers, my coworkers, kind of socializing with the supervisor. He actually went in his office and sat down and just talked to him comfortably, and I didn't understand that. And that's the way it was for a long, long time. And, you know, that's the kind of changes that take place is that, you know, one day they come to me at work and they ask me to be a boss over the rest of my work, the other 30 guys I work with, you know. And today, you better believe I'm not intimidated. I will go to any level of management, knock on his door and say, hey, I want to talk to you about something, you know. And I'm handling my job that I didn't think I was capable of doing, and I'm handling it well. I remember the first couple of months I was running my ass off and the adrenaline was pumping, and now I settled into a comfortable niche where I can go in and just get things done and it's real comfortable. It's like I belong there. And this happened when I'm 50 years old, you know, and I suppose I could have done it a long time ago, but I didn't believe that I could. Slowly I have to understand that I'm 10 times the person I thought I was, you know, and if I only get out there and try, if I only have the courage to believe that God will help me walk where I can't walk alone, then I got no problem, you know. That none of us have any problem if we want to get somewhere in life. We just can't do it our way, you know. There is a good way. There is a right way. There is the best way. And yet when we come in here, we don't want to do any of these things. We absolutely have to be beneath us. You know, we're afraid we're going to lose control, you know. And this is the best control I ever had, you know. When people look at me today and it looks like I have my life squared around pretty good, you know, it's not me. It's this power that I live with. It's this power that I believe in. It's this power I come here to share with you tonight. Because this power is here and it's willing to help. It's willing to help every single man and woman in this room. And the sorry thing is that most of you will turn it off. You know, if I ask for a show of hands, they call this a pyramid effect. If I ask for a show of hands for everybody with less than a year, two-thirds of you are going to hold up your hand. If I ask for the people with five, it will be a lot less people. If I ask for people with over 10 years, it gets down to two or three. And that's at any meeting you go to. Because the sorry thing is that people think this is a game. They don't think it's serious, and they don't have to do that, and they don't have to do that, and they're not going to give in, and they don't need any God, and all these things. And so they come in, and they stay for a while, and they go. And they try to come back, and they go. And then you don't see them, or you hear they're dead, or they're in jail, or they're in a mental institution. Now, so this is serious business, people. Coming to a meeting like this, and coming to any meeting, and becoming a part of this fellowship by being active and doing what the others have done before you will keep you here and will make your life worth something to write home about. One of the problems I had when I got here was that I hated my mother. It took me years, 3 years, to admit that. You know? And thanks to the people in here that understood and told me what I had to do and showed me what I had to do, you know, I have a very loving relationship with a mother today. You know, and I was very glad that I had affected that relationship when I lost my father 4 years ago. And I'm the oldest son of six kids, and I was able to go to my hometown in Pennsylvania. And I was able to be with this mother that I had hated for so many years. And I was able to hold her in my arms. And I was able to comfort her as we shared a man we had both loved for so many years. It's things like this that make this program worth coming to, you know. I'll be coming here when I'm 50. You're sober, I hope. Because it's contact with people like you, encouraging people like you, getting feedback, getting perspective, you know, it's what makes it work. I remember going to meetings when I was young in a program, and I would feel very distraught, and I was ready to quit it off. And I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, any meeting, anywhere, and I would sit there. And at the end of the meeting, I would leave, and I would feel great, and I knew I could handle whatever I had to handle. And I thought, what is that? You know, I went to a room, and there was a collection of drunken failures sitting around this table. And they talked for an hour. And I got up, and I went home, and I could feel better. And there was an X factor in that room, and I had to believe that there was something stronger than human power. Something that brought those two first men together 50 years ago, so that our asses today, tonight, could be saved for something worthwhile. For a plan, a life plan that God has for each of us that we can't even dream. And we have to be like children. It has to be blind. You have to reach out. You have to have the courage to step out and do things, even though you can't see the result and where it's going to turn out. You know, it's like stepping off the curb in a fog and knowing that with God's help you can get to the other side of the street and no cars are going to hit you. And over on the other side of the street is the most beautiful, magnificent event in life you ever want to be a part of, you know. And you know it's there, but you have to go. And what I go with today is the God that I know and love. The God that loves all you. The God that a lot of you don't know yet. But he's willing to listen to you in any form that you would choose to address him. Doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be formal. Can be all alone where no one can see. And 6 years sober, I went to a conference. And I used everything about my program I knew to correct a situation in my life, my stomach was a mass of knots. And this woman knew me, and she come to me and she said, Jack, you're having a problem. I said, yeah. I said, I don't know what it is. You know, I really don't understand it. I'm all up in knots. I said, I've done everything. And I said my prayers. She said, you know, I've heard you talk many times. She says, I never heard you say you get on your knees. Oh, well, you know, if he wants to listen to me, he can listen to me. I got bony knees. I can get down on the bed. And I went on with these excuses, and she says, well, she says, I want to tell you. She says, I fought the same way, you know. She says, but when I humbled myself, it's like, it's just an act, a simple act, but it says, okay, I'm humble before you. And she says, you'll get more, you know. He'll give you so much, depending on what you do, but if you want the whole nine yards, you got to do it his way. And I walked upstairs, and I went into my room, and I got down on my knees. And in 10 minutes, the tears were running down my face, and the problem I had fought for 2 months and struggled with, I had the answer to, and I felt completely serene and comfortable. And you know, to this day, I still get out of bed in the morning, and I get on my knees. And I ask only for the knowledge of God's will for me today, so that to the best of my ability, I can do what God wants for me, because I know that this is going to give me the greatest lifestyle, far more than I guess I deserve. But that's the way it is. And at the end of the day, no matter how distraught, no matter how things went wrong or what might have happened to me or what somebody did to me, you know, I say thank you. I say thank you for the power to be able to deal with my reality today. And I don't have to run. and I don't have to be afraid, and I don't have to be intimidated. I'm not afraid of anything any human being can do to me. I'm not afraid of any situation that may exist in my life. I know that me and God can handle anything that comes along. You know, anything. And I never had that assurance before. All of you have that same power. Every one of you. You have to look for it. You have to be a part of. You can't hide at this meeting. You can't hide and listen to only what you want to listen to. You can't only do what you want to do. You know, too many people don't stay here because of that. Give yourself to this program. Walk with us. Let our love touch you. And be the best human beings you ever were. Thank you.